2005, we continue to see a steady increase of all ethnic communities, but the quickest increase that we've seen in the state, or we've been able to identify, has been among the Latino community. So today it's over at over 205,000. So in 1 year we had a 5% growth. And then, as you can see in the pie chart, the majority of Minnesota's Latino community is of Mexican descent or of ethnic heritage. And going on to the governor's recommendations or the governor's budget, our base budget for this fiscal year is $314,000, and most of our budget goes to salaries, as you can imagine. The other big cost that we have, of course, is overhead costs, rent, but under that is sort of our civic engagement that I'm talking about, going to these different communities, contracting with research organizations to really help us identify those issues that are impacting Latinos. In short, the governor's recommending that we have a 5% budget reduction, and so that equates to just $16,000. Initially, as Ms. Hill said from the Indian Affairs Council, we were given a 10% budget reduction, but after further consideration, we were given a 5%. So a 5% is better than a 10%, but obviously a 0% would be more ideal. And I think I'm done, just real briefly.
Thank you, Mr. Munoz. Did the 5% of growth...
I'm sorry?
The 5% of growth
of the community.
In your Latino community, where did they come from?
We can't identify that.
Okay.
It's just a number that we use from the American Community Survey, but if you look at... The main percentage of our community is in Dakota, Hennepin, and Ramsey County, so we can assume that if 70% of the community lives in this city county metro area, then that's where we would see, you know, most of the growth. However, Greater Minnesota has seen the greatest growth, or a faster increase of Latinos. If you look into our school districts, you know, you walk into an elementary classroom in Worthington, half of the elementary class is, you know, students of color, so we can't ignore the fact that Greater Minnesota is also growing as well.
But did they come from other states or from within the state?
Historically, Minnesota's Latino community has come here through the migrant trend and have settled. But now we see year-round sustainable industries such as the meat packaging plant. So we see a lot of folks not only coming from the Southwest, but also coming, you know, beyond the U.S. borders.
Thank you. When you submit it to the governor for consideration of a budget, was your budget at the 5% or the 10% or the 0%?
Madam Chair, we submitted a budget forecast for the 10% in December, and then before December, and then in December we submitted a budget forecast for a 5%. So we had to submit two budgets, one with 10% and the other with 5%. So initially the 10% budget reduction that we were given was $32,000 per fiscal year, and now with the 5%, as you know, it's $16,000.
And Mr. Munoz, you expressed to us your relationship with the legislature and what you've done to improve your relationships with the legislature. But what about with your community throughout the state of Minnesota?
Madam Chair, what we've done the past 3 years has really informed the community as far as our role in state government and how to bridge them to the legislative process. And so there's been a lot of civic engagement with those cluster communities that we talked about in really letting them know that we are that conduit to state government. And 2 weeks ago, it really proved the 2 years of hard work that we were able to, you know, to do, to inform them of our role and of their need to be involved in the legislative process. What our Latino community members did was also meet with their representatives, both senators and representatives, House representatives, to inform them of those issues. So a lot of relationship building both in the legislature and also with our community, so twofold.
Would you please supply to us the issue, the items on the sheet, the 9 items on the sheet that you did not answer in your oral remarks to our committee?
Sure. Yes, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Chair Guest. I'm sorry coming in late.
But as I look at your biennium calendar and your kind of work plan, which I thank you for organizing your work with sort of a regular expectation, but I didn't see a lot of consultation with other state agencies and how they're working with, Latino populations and others. I know the Department of Health has a huge initiative to address health disparities. And can you tell us a little bit about how much you're interacting with other state agencies in your work?
Madam Chair and Representative, we've done a lot of work working with other state agencies. Most recently, we published a report in January, last January 2009, with a grant that we received from the Department of Health to do work on eliminating health disparities within our community. So we have begun to use those or utilize those networks within state government to best execute initiatives that the state has for all communities. Another issue that we have worked on is on K-12 education. Yesterday we met with Commissioner Segrin to advise her and let her know what those best practices are for students of color in addressing the achievement gap. So we have worked, or we continue to work, with departments and other state agencies that have similar missions or initiatives to address issues that impact communities of color in the state.
Thank you very much. Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Herr.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Eileen Herr, and I'm the Executive Director for the Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans. And I have with me a presentation that answers your questions, and then a blue folder, which is our random report, and it's right over there, and I know I talked to the page, and he's going to be distributing it to you. But while he's making distribution, I just want to talk about the council organizational chart. We are an advisory board to the members of the legislature, the governor, and the executive branch. The governor appoints our board, and then our board, to facilitate its work, hires myself, the executive director, to manage the staff and to manage our work product. We currently have four full-time employees, including myself, an office manager, and two management analysts. The council was created in 1985 by the Minnesota State Legislature in response to a request from the community. And the question was, can the Asian American community, which was growing at that time in Minnesota, have a voice, a permanent voice, in the institutional decisions that were being made that affected the community? And at that time, members of the legislature and the governor said yes, and thus the council was created. And my council, the Asian Pacific Council, is the youngest council, was the last council to be created. It's not surprising in that with regards to growth of the Asian Pacific community, we are the newest community in Minnesota. That in census, in the 1970 census, there was only about 7,000 Asians in Minnesota. And now, 2010, we're being projected at about 210 or 220 in the state of Minnesota. This growth was a result of two things. One, of course, in the 1970s, the relaxing of federal immigration law, which allowed Asians to come back into the United States of America, either through work, employment, or education. And then the second part, the biggest part, was a result of the 1970s conflict in Southeast Asia, in which brought more than 50% of the Asian American population to Minnesota, of which my family and I are one. And my ethnic background is I'm Hmong, and I came to the United States in 1976 one of the first waves of refugees from Laos to come to the United States of America. So in the last 30 years, the Asian American community in Minnesota has just doubled, tripled, quadrupled, in that in 1990 to 2000 census, the community grew almost 100%, and now we're projected to grow roughly maybe 50%, because there was a sense that there was an undercount. So I was using that to fill the hole, and now you have the information in front of you, so I will proceed with the presentation that is before you. You see here our enabling statute, and there are about 15 mandates that are in the enabling statute, but we have divided it into three equal sections. One is to really take serious the role of advisor to the governor and members of the legislature on issues pertaining to the Asian Pacific Minnesotan community. And I think we've done a good job of that, in that we have responded to requests from members of the legislature and the executive branch with regards to Department of Health, Department of Education, Department of Economic Security with regards to workforce development and training issues. We've done our best to be a resource to you all. I don't think we've done the best that we can. There is still more opportunity definitely for us to partner and to serve as your advisor. Two is that we advocate on issues of importance to the Asian American community, and this is where our engagement with the community comes in. And then third is to act as a broker between the Asian Pacific community and the mainstream community. And so here you see our organizational chart, and I want to acknowledge my board, and they are so active, and as you can see here, they've organized themselves into four task groups of things on which to be active and to take a active participation role. Here on page 3, you'll see the revenue source and expenditure for FY, fiscal year 2007 and 2008, the current biennium. And as you can see that from fiscal 07 to fiscal 08, we had a significant jump of about $50,000. And that was because the economy, the state's economy was in balance or surplus, and when times were good, then our budget was increased, and that helped us a lot to maintain our staff. The next, if you just flip over, I did ask the question of whether in fiscal 09 there was any unallowment, and because our budget is so tight, we had no unallowment. In FY, for the next biennium budget request, this is my original request to our CFO. And in here, this budget here will actually fund us at current staffing level, including cost of living expenses, and then just the usual 3% cost of living expenses that's built into this budget. And if you flip over, then you have the governor's recommendation, and the governor's recommending that we do get a 5% cut. That where we are currently at 289, we would go down to 275 for the next 2 years. And this has a lot of impact. One is impact on the staff. Definitely, we will either see salary reduction, reduction in staff from four to three, and utilizing unpaid leave of absence, which a lot of industries are using right now to balance their budget. This will have an impact on performance, in that with four staff, we're barely making a presence statewide, but with three staff, that's definitely going to be harder, because we do have a statewide mandate, and we take that very seriously. The Asian community is throughout the state of Minnesota, and we feel that we can serve governments, cities, and counties, work and serve their Asian American population better in throughout the state of Minnesota. But with the reduction in our budget, I don't think we're going to be able to do that or to do that effectively. We will have to reduce projects and issues on which to work. So instead of working on five or six issues, we may have to limit it down to just only top two issues. which means that we will have to reduce partnerships with community groups and nonprofits and state agencies that are already going on. We will definitely have to reduce our role and effort in Census 2010 if I take away a staff. What are we going to do? And the census is so important to our community in terms of bringing resources to our community. And in 2000, we were very, very active in taking leadership role. I've been elected as from the community to serve as the chair of the Asian American Pacific Islander Complete Town Committee. That's the type of leadership they expect from the council. That's the type of leadership they expect from the state, a state agency. And so I've taken on that role, but as I told them, with no budget, how are we going to get resources, outreach into the community, making sure that each and every Asian American does indeed get counted? So I actually would like some money to do some of that, but the economy and in the foundation, it's going to be a struggle. We're going to have to reduce community convenings, forums, and town hall meetings. And then we definitely are going to be a limited voice on community issues to policymakers and legislators. So in our terms of our role as advisors to you all, I do believe we are going to have a limited voice. If we do get this 4% reduction, that's $14,000 per year, and reducing our staff, we will have to most likely end our commemoration of the month of May as Asian American and Pacific Islander Heritage Month, and we are very proud that we've taken a leading role in the last 20 years to commemorate and provide educational resources for the community and other education institutions to celebrate May as Asian American Heritage Month. And then we will definitely have to stop awarding or at least suspending the annual presentation of our prestigious and respected Asian Pacific Leadership Award, in which we recognize outstanding individuals or organizations in the community that does a lot of work to help the community. Briefly, I did want to focus on performance outcomes for the current biennium. And as you can see here, I mean, there's so many things, but everything, we pick priorities and then we work on them to see if we have, in effect, made any progress. So with regards to, and these are in line with the Minnesota milestones, so we picked the top three issues on which to work. One is people and children. Out of that, we picked two issues, reduced runaway and teen pregnancy. And the reducing the runaway really ties into human sex trafficking, too. And so I think we've acted, you've been really wonderful, particularly the House is taking leadership on passing legislation and providing the funding for the state's human and sex trafficking legislation. So I want to thank you for that. And then reducing teen pregnancy with regards to early teenage marriages and pregnancy, and I think we've gone a long way in terms of producing results in that area. To the area of community and democracy, going back to really commemorating Heritage Month in terms of community building. And then the third part is taking on the role of civic engagement. And how we work on that is to work really hard to increase the Asian American Pacific Islander voters in terms of registered and voting rates. And then the economy, really trying to increase Asian American Pacific Islander access to job training and workforce programs. And currently, right now, we are working with Representative Joe Mullery on just the idea of retraining and job training programs. And then I've heard from the community, too, that make sure that the stimulus package that the president signed comes to our community in terms of job training and retraining, because our community is new to this country, and primarily 40 to 50% work in the low-skilled, low-paid manufacturing jobs, which are the first to go, and so we've seen a lot of layoffs in our community. They come to our council asking for help to get jobs, and I'm like, oh, I can't do that. Let me partner with the Minnesota Workforce Centers to see if they can help you. But if you don't know how to read and write and use the computers, how can you put up your resume into that system? How can you even adequately fill out online forms to get unemployment benefits, and so we see a lot of issues with regards to that.
We're talking about that in higher ed workforce.
Thank you.
There's a place for that.
So I'll stop here. I know my time is limited. I want to address your issue and your concerns, so if you have questions, I'm more than happy to answer them.
Thank you so much. We appreciate it. And is it possible that you can work with the Census Bureau, the census people, because they're taking applications at this time, and for that person that might have to leave your employee could get a job at the census, and then we would still be able to solve our problem.
Madam Chair, right now, currently, because there is no Secretary for the Commerce, Department, there is no U.S. Census chief, so because of lack of voice, the federal census office is behind, and my fear is that because they are behind, the state is going to be behind in terms of our work and outreach. In 2000, by this time, we were set already this time around, because Minnesota has a lot to lose on the table. I would, the onus is on us to really do as much as we can, and you are correct. We are working really hard with the state office to hire as much from the community as possible, and that is ongoing, and that is currently happening. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
All right.
Mr. Collins, Council on Black Minnesota, welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Good morning.
And members, my name is Lester Collins. As I said in the Senate hearing, I have some dental work going on, so it kind of sounds like I kind of got a lisp here. So I will talk as clearly as I possibly can this morning.
And quickly.
And quickly as I possibly can. Without losing what they call the flapper in my... Again, my name is Lester Collins. I'm the Executive Director of the Council on Black Minnesotans, and have been with the council for about 22 years. So I've been around for a while. And the gentleman I have next to me is Roger Banks, our research analyst that has been with the council for about 6 years at this particular point. I prepared a packet for you, which I think answers for sure all 9 questions. I also have what would be a table of content that you ought to also have, to kind of list the stuff at least that you have in the yellow folder there with you. I will try to go through it as quickly as I possibly can. In terms of the agency mission, it is really very similar to the other 4 councils, may differ a bit from the Indian Affairs Council, but it is to advise the legislature, the governor, on issues impacting African and African Americans in the state of Minnesota. Both populations, which are continuing to increase, similar to the other councils, or at least as they have reported. I think according to the last census, we were at about 220 or so, which I think is definitely, and other councils will agree, undercount as it relates to our population. I think that was about a 28% increase from the 2000 census. The one thing I want to mention before I forget it is not only do we work with the other state agencies, I'm talking about the Department of Health and Corrections and Human Services, but I think it's also important that you know and realize that we also work with ourselves or among ourselves. And recently, to kind of formalize that relationship, we created what was and worked for months at kind of identifying common issues that we have, and had agreement that we would work more closely on those particular issues, and they would be like education, child protection related issues, foster care, that kind of stuff. Not to overly elaborate, but we actually created a collaboration of memorandum of collaboration among ourselves, just to clarify and to kind of commit to that. So I thought it was important to mention that, and that these bodies not only work with other government agencies, but we work very closely with ourselves. Job descriptions are included in the packet, and I think pretty much delineate the various roles that each of the staff play. We are at present at approximately, I think it's like three and a half individuals. And the reason why I would even stutter to mention what that is, we are also fortunate enough to have one of the staff people is not a contract employee, it's actually a state employee, but the funds or money are made available. Initially it was made by the Minnesota Partnership Against Tobacco, and that grant or funding ended. We successfully completed tobacco cessation kinds of stuff. And we then entered recently into a new contract with Blue Cross Blue Shield. So one of those positions is a position that is funded while that individual is a state employee. The funding for that position is supplied by Blue Cross Blue Shield. And I think our grant, you know, from them is about $300,000 over a, I think it's a three-year period. And so we've had that for a while and successfully have carried out that work and hope to continue it. We also hope to, if you will, we've kind of incubated this whole sensation education around tobacco, particularly for our African and African-American community. But we're hoping to also launch that organization so that it stands alone and on itself or by itself. And that's one of our primary goals in that regard. Quickly, I guess, in terms of, you also have an organization chart, which I won't try to, you know, speak to. You have our biannual report, which mentions goals and those kind of things. You have the agency profile and the budget related. And let me say quickly, and I don't really see the time, but one of the things that we have been asked originally was the 10%. We submitted that. And then, as other councils have indicated, and I don't want to be too redundant, we were asked to cut by 5%. That represents, for us, approximately a $330,000 budget. It means about roughly about $17,000 in reduction to our operations. That will come from salaries of the employees that we have. We did the same thing in 2003. And Roger, for instance, is at, what, 64%?
Right.
You know, from 2003, he's remained at so. And my salary was reduced, other individual salaries, and that's what we will end up doing. We will probably, also we have a half-time staff position. It will probably mean the elimination of that position and reduction, you know, of myself and the other two employees that we have. We will probably not reduce Roger. He's at 64% and was kind enough to be cooperative in that particular regard. So that's essentially from a budget kind of standpoint. Roger essentially, for the most part, produces, I think, a very good biannual report and has done so for the last couple of years. I'm going to let him speak to maybe some of the goals and those kinds of things that we have established. Before he does so, I will say that the way that we arrive at goals for the council and have just completed three community forums on a statewide kind of basis where we let our constituents essentially, as you do, talk to you and essentially bring their concerns and issues. And then based on those, we try to prioritize what it is that we're hearing, those recommendations. So we've had forums around, for instance, criminal justice, health, economic development. Education would be the next that we will have. But I think there's another area that we've identified that may, for the moment, put education not being any less important. And I can't remember exactly what that is, something else that we're about to do that's going to take precedence over that education. It's just not coming to me right now. Having said that, and the many things I can say, I'm going to let Roger kind of speak to some of the goals that we've established for the council.
Thank you, Mr. Banks.
Right. Thank you very much, Chairman Murphy and members of the committee. I would first like to address some of the goals and also then address some of the outcomes that are associated with those particular goals. And if you will look in your agency profile under the rubric of under the heading of goals, you'll find that the first one is reducing the level of racial disparities and disproportionalities experienced by African and African Americans in the state of Minnesota. I have to be very frank in terms of letting you know that we've not been that successful in that particular endeavor. And a lot of that has to do with essentially the status of the information gathering and reporting process. It's very difficult for an organization like the Council on Black Minnesotans or any other organization that focuses on the needs of cultural groups and American Indians that to really identify specifically the level and intensity of the problems essentially facing them. That's true in the area of racial disparities as it pertains to education, health disparities, juvenile justice or criminal justice disparities, etc. So what I'm saying in essence is that if you will, I would really urge you to read our biennial report, because there is a large section in there dealing with research and research information gathering, reporting, and utilization by the state. Because what we feel essentially is that given the status of data collection in the state of Minnesota, that not only are we, i.e. the council, at a disadvantage, but that you, as policymakers, do not have the accurate information that allows you to make good decisions about the status of your populations of color and American Indians. The second has to do with increasing the knowledge of policymakers. In that endeavor, what we've done essentially is to hold resource fairs up here at the state capitol with the idea of acting as a resource for the legislature. We have also been able to act as resources for a whole range of departmental, you know, agency committees. For example, the 2020 transition program for seniors and individuals with disabilities. We serve on that. We serve on the advisory group for the health disparities. We serve on a whole range of educational issues, organizations like Representative Carlos Mariani's Minnesota Minority Education Project. Those kind of things where we offer our assistance and our expertise as it pertains to our population. And so those are just two of the goals that you have the others before you, but I'd just like to really suggest or urge you to read our biennial report, and particularly the section on research. Thank you.
Thank you so much. We appreciate your attendance, and we will get back to you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Public broadcasting. Public television. Welcome to committee, Mr. Straczynski.
Good morning, Madam Chair. Thank you very much. I'm Bill Straczynski, and I represent the interests of the Friends of Minnesota Public Television. And first of all, I want to thank the committee for its past support, in particular with the digital appropriations and the grant appropriations we've received from the state of Minnesota over the years. It's interesting to note that the first grant to public television was in 1956 by the Minnesota Legislature, $25,000 to then educational station TPT, Channel 2. Excuse me. So our history is long and deep with the state of Minnesota, and we certainly hope you see the value in our services. Public television frequencies were reserved by the federal government in the 1940s. Congress specifically charged these stations with the responsibility to preserve our democracy, and provide our citizens with the opportunity to freely exchange ideas and issues important to the community. And if you think about that for just one moment, using Duluth, Minnesota as an example, public
what
television. But it's true, it's applicable statewide, Madam Chair. Public television is the only publicly owned entity to distribute information to the public, news, what have you, current events in the city of Duluth. Everything is also owned by some national corporation housed or domiciled in Georgia or elsewhere in Minnesota. The only other channel television station in Minnesota happens to be Channel 5 here owned by Stan Hutt, but everything else is not owned here. So the importance of the ability to preserve this legacy is quite obvious. In the digital environment, our ability to bring more programming to the public has been greatly expanded. Each analog channel will be replaced by 4 digital channels. This digital environment presents many more opportunities to partner with nonprofits, community-based organizations, so as to bring their message to a much larger audience. One of our new channels will be programmed exclusively as a Safe Harbor Children's and Educational Channel. Another channel is being programmed as the Minnesota Channel, which focuses on making state government more transparent and accessible to the public. For example, we provide gavel-to-gavel coverage of the Minnesota Legislature, including all 4 floor sessions and several committee hearings. Other channels will be used to continue and educate the public on important issues, ranging from how to deal with the stress of losing your job to helping National Guard families that have a member deployed to Iraq, Afghanistan, or Bosnia cope with the stress of that family member leaving and helping that person integrate back into society when they return from that deployment. And of course, we'll continue to provide great cultural and public affairs programming that you have come to appreciate. Public television is viewed as a provider of quality programming and interactive services for the public from cradle to the grave. Madam Chair, if I could draw your attention to the handout that I gave you this morning, and we're trying to save some money and it happens to have PPC jackets. We don't have one for the Public Television Association. In the handout, you'll notice that we do have a map on the right-hand side, and the map is fairly current. It does not reflect the transmitter, which is now broadcasting in the Hibbing area, covering the entire Iron Range. That's one handout for you. The second page behind that kind of basically discloses, you know, what some of our viewers are. We get Nielsen ratings, we get Pew reports, we know who's watching public television and how often they're watching it. It gives you some demographic information. I think the standard number we use is about 2.5 million people watch public television on a monthly basis. The next page, this handout really talks about the Minnesota Channel, which has been active for over a year since we got our initial appropriation from legislature for digital conversion. It was a $40 million conversion effort, by the way, in which the Minnesota legislature provided $14 million for equipment and what have you. It talks about the overview about some of the things we're doing on the Minnesota Channel, which is statewide. And I think particularly on the next page, the final page, take a look at the partners that we are working with in your communities throughout the state of Minnesota. That's the public television. We are able to work with those organizations and bring their message to a much, much larger audience. On the left-hand side of the handout, you have an organizational chart, basically which talks about our organization. It talks about the Public Television Association, and that's important because the appropriations you have made in the past provide for the Public Television Association to make recommendations to the Commissioner of Administration as to how these grants should be dispersed. Identifies each public television station, and each public television station by federal law has a community advisory board made up of the citizens. And each station in Minnesota is owned and operated by the public, by their communities. Not like a lot of states where public television is owned and operated by state government. And the standard core functions are also identified here of what each state and basically the activities they're involved with on a day-to-day basis include. And then I have another handout basically that talks about the partnership with the state of Minnesota and the things that public television, even though we're independently owned and operated, the areas where we partner with the state of Minnesota, and I think it's really very informative.
Do you want to touch on finances, Mr.
Yes, I'm sure. I'm headed next.
Before your time runs out?
Madam Chair, our total budget for public television serving the citizens of Minnesota is about $31 million. We have 260 full-time equivalent employees. The state contributions to our budget range from anywhere from 2.5% of a station's budget up to 22% of the station's budget when you take a look at the Bemidji, Appleton areas and what have you. The governor recommended the base level of funding, the one-time funding that we secured last biennium. Hope would translate into new base money. This biennium was not recommended for further funding. That means, I think it was $1.5 million reduction in funding going forward if you do adopt the base budget. And you should note that we match all funds from the state of Minnesota with funds from other sources. And we don't get our money from the state of Minnesota for the most part until we match and raise it locally under statute. We have to raise money locally. We match it with state dollars. We take state dollars and match it with federal dollars and other dollars. So not only is it cut about $1.5 million, the long-term ramifications can be another $1.5 million in cuts. I'd like to share just a couple of facts about public television. It's available to over 4.7 million residents in Minnesota. Each station is community owned and operated. We work with 275 school districts and 192,000 students. All our state grant funds are matched, as I previously mentioned. And public television also serves more people more often than any other cultural or education organization in Minnesota. In fact, people who tune into public television each month will fill the Metrodome 42 times, Orchestra Hall 816 times, and Yardways 1,052 times. According to the national survey, and this has always been important to us, most states, the average contribution from state governments to public television in other states, and all states do fund public television, is $1.20 per capita. In Minnesota, we're about 42 cents. Public television has always been team players when it comes to cutting budgets. We have benefited from the good times and struggled in the difficult times along with the state of Minnesota. However, our current grant appropriations are about 1994 levels. And during the first 2 months of this year, our revenues in public television are down dramatically, about 13% on average. And for example, we've been laying off staff and cutting appropriations, cutting budgets where we have to because it's required. And some stations have eliminated services to daycare and preschool teachers and parents to focus on their K-12 services. That means no more workshops on parenting and early childhood development, and no more distribution of books to disadvantaged families. Typically, each station will give 3,000 to 5,000 of those books away each year. They're training materials used in daycare in a daycare environment. So we're already making the cuts. We're already trying to live within our budget because we're feeling the economic downturn. Finally, our mission is public television is you. Our mission is basically the same as yours. We want to have an informed public and develop good citizens. We pledge to you, Madam Chair and the committee, to use our state dollars wisely to continue to take current events, cultural events, programs about our environment, our history, and our heritage to a statewide audience. And finally, as you make your decisions, please remember that public television cannot meet its financial obligations alone. The partnership with the state of Minnesota is extremely important. Even though our stations are masters at raising money, the digital environment is very expensive. But the opportunities are enormous. We need your help to meet these new challenges, and we'll be more than happy and willing to be held accountable for our product and our services. We will continue to provide measurable objectives, and we will leverage all state funds going to public television. We can guarantee you a very large bang for the buck. And I'd just like to conclude by saying that the Roper Poll, which is a national survey done for over 20 years, has identified public television as the most trusted source of information in the United States. And when you ask the public throughout the country about is it worthy of state taxpayer investment, it's ranked number 2 behind the Department of Defense spending. Public television is number 2. Thank you for your time, Madam Chair.
We're still going to have big birds, though, aren't we?
Well, we hope so, Madam Chair. Big Bird is not working with a special program with the National Guard unit that has just been deployed and trying to help both families. They've got a wonderful program going on right now. In fact, the chaplain of the National Guard just said, thanks to Big Bird and the things the public television is doing with the National Guard and their families, they'll be saving lives and helping reduce a lot of stress. So,
Big Bird. Okay, thank you. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Drzewski, I commend you for the fine work that you do, and according to some of your statistics, we are indeed getting more for less than Minnesota.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, on the ratings that you were talking about, how does the legislative program rate?
Chairman, I don't know if we do a statistical.
Thank you very much, Don. Minnesota Public Radio. Thank you.
I'm just wondering if it would pay for us to
Mr. Nelson.
In the pledge drive.
Mr. Nelson.
We could do a pledge drive.
No pledge drive.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Nelson. I'm the Public Affairs Director for Minnesota Public Radio, and I live and work here in St. Paul. I'd like to, first of all, thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of public broadcasting along with our fine colleagues in public television and the Amper station.
Running short, so we got to quick.
We can be very quick. Minnesota Public Radio reaches approximately 800,000 Minnesotans weekly through three regional services. Those listeners, on average, spend 8.5 hours per week with us. In greater Minnesota, more than 250,000 people listen to NPR each week. Minnesota Public Radio employs 365 people across the state with roles in public radio programming, new media, and support services. Current organizational chart is on the back of the packet that they're distributing, along with our most recent financial statement. NPR uses its technical infrastructure to provide important services to the state of Minnesota in addition to its radio programming. There are four services uniquely provided by NPR. With its network stations, Minnesota Public Radio serves as the backbone to the state's emergency alert system. NPR provides the signals in the event of an emergency to all other radio stations, television stations, and cable providers across Minnesota. Minnesota Public Radio also plays an important role in our most important resource, our children, by serving as the radio backbone to the state's Amber Alert system, providing Amber Alerts to all of the radio stations, television stations, and cable providers across Minnesota. NPR also provides a special subcarrier signal for the Radio Talking Book, a reading service offered by Minnesota State Services for the Blind. Since 1968, the Radio Talking Book service has broadcast readings of current print newspapers, books, and periodicals to those unable to read these publications themselves. In addition, NPR is the sole backup for the public radio satellite system. In the event of an emergency or disaster in our nation's capital, the backup system at Minnesota Public Radio is capable of quickly coming online and to provide a continuity of national programming for all the public radio stations in the country. Minnesota Public Radio's mission, vision, and values are articulated in the packets that have been distributed. Quite simply, our goal is, along with our friends in Amper, to provide Minnesota with the finest public radio service in the world. In addition to public radio, we also have a very robust system of websites that are visited more than 3 million times every month. These websites, which are both news, arts, culture, are also a very important service, and we're continuing to devote more resources to our web presence. We also have a lot of public events that are held throughout the state and at the Fitzgerald Theater here in St. Paul. I mentioned in previous testimony our Rock the Cradle event that was held in partnership with the Minneapolis Institute of Art and the Children's Theater Company. I'm happy to say that 2 years ago, 4,000 people came. I just got the numbers for this year. 11,770 people came to that event last month. These events are a very important part of what we do as Minnesota Public Radio. We're both a radio station as well as a part of our communities, the communities that we serve throughout the state. Throughout the years, Minnesota Public Radio has worked diligently to maintain, improve, and expand public radio service to greater Minnesota. This includes 34 stations and 19 translators serving almost all of the state. Yet, in the most recent report by the National Telecommunications Infrastructure Administration, stated that 175,000 Minnesotans cannot currently receive a public radio signal in their homes, whether provided by Minnesota Public Radio or our colleagues in the Amper station. In order to increase the number of Minnesotans that receive a public radio signal, we partner with you, the state of Minnesota, to build, maintain, and upgrade our statewide network. Recent state funding was used to build new stations and upgrade current stations to broadcast digitally. MCL received a $3.02 million appropriation for the current biennium. That funding was used to build a new wide-area service station in the Roseau-War Road region and for the digital upgrade of 17 of our regional stations. Our performance measures for that appropriation were really the completion of those projects, and I'm happy to say that they have all been completed, and we are currently broadcasting in the Roseau-War Road region. Recognizing the fiscal challenges facing the state, MCR is requesting an appropriation for 2010-2011 that is less than half of what we received in the current biennium. There's a two-pager detailing that request in the packets that have been distributed. First of all, in order to provide public broadcasting services to Minnesotans currently not without our signal, we are requesting $850,000 in state funding to build three new full-power wide-area service stations in Ely, Hinckley, and International Falls. We have secured federal funding for these new stations and FCC permits to begin construction. Unfortunately, FCC construction permits have expiration dates. In this case, they're in 2010 and 2011. If we're not able to complete construction of these projects, we will lose those permits and will not be able to build these stations. So we really are reliant on state funding to move forward with these projects. We are also requesting $525,000 appropriation to complete the digital conversion of Minnesota stations, Minnesota Public Radio stations in Buell, Brainerd, Fergus Falls, and La Crescent. Digital conversion is the single largest capital project Minnesota Public Radio has undertaken in greater Minnesota. Our goal is to provide the entire state with the same digital service that is currently available in the Twin Cities. It will improve the underlying infrastructure of our entire network, provide high-quality audio to listeners with digital receivers, and eliminate many interference issues in areas that currently have a marginal analog signal. This one-time federally matched funding will complete the digital conversion of all MCR stations in the state. For both of these projects, we have secured about $1.1 million in federal funds. And again, unfortunately, if we're not able to secure the state funding, it's likely that those federal matching funds will go to waste. We are currently in the governor's budget for $190,000 in 2010. In 2011, there is an appropriation for public broadcasting, but it's not broken down, so we don't know how much goes to MCR and the other public broadcasters in the state. Because we spent our current appropriation, our projects are moving along quite quickly, we are not a candidate for unallotment, so that money is out the door. We are very grateful to the public-private partnership that has made Minnesota Public Radio what it is today. We look forward to expanding our mission of community service well into the future. I can answer any questions, and I have colleagues here if I don't know the answer.
Thank you. Maybe at a later time you can give us a recommendation on how that money should be divided.
I'm sure that our colleagues in AMPRS and Public TV will have a thought about that as well.
I bet they'll do the same. Mr. Nelson, where are you on this?
Well, oh, that's a very good question. I am underneath Tom Keegan, our executive vice president, who is sitting right there. Uh-huh. He's my boss. Someday I hope you get a promotion so I have my own boss.
Well, I would think. And based on your regular attendance and participation in this committee activities, I would think that you should not wait for someday. Thank you very much. Mr. Tilley? Ampers? Ampers on little radio stations?
Good morning.
Question, Mr. Tilley.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Barry Tilley. I represent the Association of Minnesota Public Educational Radio Stations, and in a moment I will, which is AMPRS, the Association of Minnesota Public Educational Radio Stations, and in a moment I'll introduce our president. The pages are distributing our handouts right now, Madam Chair, one of which will be a booklet, which is our station booklet, and if you'll turn into there's a map on the inside that shows our signal areas, and then the very next page is a list of things that includes an abbreviated portion of our mission statement, which is the second bullet there. Another document that you're getting, and by the way, the rest of this is a station by station description of each of the stations, listing their power, their transmitters, and the type of programming and their frequencies and that sort of thing. I keep one of these in my car, so as I travel around the state, I can listen to all the great amateur stations that I can do. And another is our roster, which on the back has our organizational charts, our list of officers and board members. And finally, the third is a page out of the appropriation bill from 2007, which breaks down the appropriations for all of public broadcasting. And I've highlighted the section for AMPRS at the bottom. It's my understanding that the governor, when he recommended funding for public broadcasting in his budget recommendations, recommended as the base for each of the activities the amount received in the second year of the biennium. That is our base amount, which the governor has recommended. It's my understanding, Madam Chair. Unfortunately, some of the AMPRS stations were affected by on allotments, and three of our stations received major reductions of over nearly $25,000 in each of their appropriations, which was very hurtful and is causing severe budget problems for those three stations. The AMPRS is made up of 12 different stations, 11 of which qualify for public funding. Our stations have a practice and a policy of recognizing the state of Minnesota for their contributions, as we recognize all of our underwriters, and our stations on the air acknowledge the grants from the state of Minnesota appropriated by the legislature. And we feel that we're proud to receive those grants, and we recognize all of the people who contributed to our stations. And now, Madam Chair, I know time is short. I'm going to introduce our president, Jim Gullickson. He got up way before breakfast this morning to be here when the committee began at 8:30. Jim is the manager of KMFU in Mankato, and he will tell you a little bit more about our organization.
Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, thank you for your time, everyone here. And I'm the volunteer president for AMPRS, and so I serve a term of 1 year, and if I do a good enough job, maybe I'll be reelected. I represent the 12 stations of AMPRS here before you today, and just wanted you to know how much all of the stations, the 11 stations that receive state appropriations, really, really, truly appreciate the support that you've offered us over the number of years, and we hope that we've lived up to our accountability on that. We really do rely on those appropriations for much of what we have for operating costs. Lots of the stations that are part of the AMPRS group operate on very, very tight budgets. I'll use our station as an example because I'm most familiar with it. I'm at Minnesota State University, Mankato. I operate, I'm the general manager of KMSU and KMSK in Austin, another licensed FM that also carries our signal. And we have two full-time employees, and the rest of our operation is done by really volunteers and students. And this is not atypical for many of the stations, many of the university-licensed stations. We're able to make our funds stretch out to the end of the year, usually by a hair. But it really does matter that we get these state appropriations, so we're very grateful for that. And it does help us to do what we do every day, which is reach diverse audiences. We have a number of stations that do outreach to audiences of color. In our case, we do 6 hours of Hispanic programming on Saturdays and reach the Latino audience, which, as you heard earlier from Mr. Munoz, is a growing audience in South Central Minnesota, the area that we serve. So, and we're certainly not alone in that endeavor. And so, again, we just really appreciate the support that you've given us in the past, and look forward to your support in the future.
Thank you, Mr. Tillage. What were the three stations that were on allotted?
Madam Chair, committee members, KXE in Grand Rapids, KMFU, President Gullickson Station in Mankato, and KSRQ in Deep River Falls were all unallotted about a little less than $25,000 per station. And
because they hadn't spent the money quickly enough?
Or? Their application process was not yet completed. The stations that received their grants had their applications were completed, and because there is no real deadline, and based on the situations in each of the stations' institutions, they submit their applications over a couple of months. I suspect that we will never have a tardy applicant again, Madam Chair. But this very truly did. Two of the three stations are located in institutions. Institutions themselves are under budget stress, and which is unlikely to get much worse. KSRQ in Thief River Falls is in the process of doing a transition from a total institution-based system to a community-based station, and it's really nip and tuck. It's a great station, dedicated people, but they're in dire straits. As you know, our budgets range from under $200,000 in a couple of the smaller stations to a little over $1 million in our biggest station. One of our stations, KFAI in South Minneapolis, sees as their mission to serve the immigrant community. They broadcast in 12 or 13 different languages sometime during the week. They have 150 volunteer programmers that are on the air at least once a month. People who put the shows together on their own time and compete for the airspace. There are a lot of neat things happening in public radio stations, and we are truly blessed in Minnesota by all the stations with the Minnesota Public Radio, with the Public Television Association, and the Empress Station. And we're all different, and we all have significant community support, people who want our services. We have found that when we tell that we are supported by the state of Minnesota, we get some people to say, my goodness, some of my tax money is going to the right place, you know. Everybody feels that they're paying, that they're involved and they're committed. And it's to the thanks of the legislature for involving the state in this great public service.
Representative Hodge.
Thank you very much. I just this last weekend, 40 of my friends and associates gathered around our radio and listened to KVFC for 50 hours. And that's because they have an annual trivia contest, and our trivia team's name is Sigma Phi Nothing, which was my college fraternity. And I answered two questions, went close on three in 50 hours, which is an improvement from my other years.
Well, Representative Haas, we actually carried that simulcast from St. Cloud as an experiment, but it was really delightful to hear that on our airwaves as well. So collaborated on it.
Madam Chair and testifier, there's players because of the technology, which I argue with my friend Rukavina on. Actually, there's players throughout the world that come in via the computer and radio. Interesting.
That's a good point, Representative Haas. All of our stations do what they call webcasting. You can tap away on your computer, and I listen at my desk to our station in Grand Rapids, our station in Mankato, our stations in Duluth on a regular basis. And at pledge time, they get pledges from all over the country, and quite a few from Europe, from Minnesotans that have been transplanted that listen to home but via their computers on the webcasting. It's a delightful experience.
Sometimes we even listen in another state. Mr. Gullickson, for clarification, would you please tell me again, you're a volunteer president?
Yes.
Okay. But you're a station manager.
I'm a station manager. That's my real job, and my volunteer job is this.
And your board is lenient enough to let you go and do presidential duties on their time?
As needed, yes.
All right. And
thank
that's
you.
Why you're here today.
That's why I'm here today.
Very good. Thank you very much for coming. This meeting is adjourned.